Eusebius of Caesarea maintains that Constantius never actually demolished any churches. And he actually also, according to Eusebius, also Eusebius also maintains that he never actually also killed any Christians. There are debates about this. As the Caesar that would have been a part of the Roman Empire in the West that he would have had direct control over, which was actually Britain. But there is a martyr in Britain, St. Albans. It's a little town not far from London that remembers the martyrdom of this man. On the other hand, Constantius' religious convictions are curious. Some of his coinage that was issued under his name have pagan gods on it. Mars, Jupiter, Hercules, which indicate that there is a fluidity about, or there's a elements of confusion about exactly what did he believe. And Constantius' religious convictions are not clear. Constantine will say at one point that of all the emperors who preceded him, there is only one with whom he has any sympathy, and that is his father. Every other emperor, he said, is in hell. So, again, but you might say, well, that you expect the son to speak that way about his father. So, it's not very clear. It's not clear, Constantius' commitments. Within a year of Constantius becoming emperor, he is dead. And in 306, Constantine is declared emperor. He's declared emperor in the city of York in England, which was known by the Latin in those days as Eboracum. And so it would be in the Roman province of Britannia. One of the things that is, if you ever have the opportunity to go to Europe, I would encourage you to do so. It just gives you just a richer sense of history in so many ways because of the antiquity of stuff over there. And I remember being in York. Actually, you can actually go. There's a wall there that was standing. And in fact, in front of that wall, the troops, it was being part of the fortress, I believe, the troops of Constantius declared Constantine emperor. Now, the problem was that he wasn't the Caesar. He wasn't the man who's supposed to succeed. And the system devised by Diocletian was already beginning to break down. Was Constantine ambitious for power? I think there's evidence that is so. He's been raised in an imperial household. He's been accustomed to power. There is an element of ambition that drives the man. But where did he stand theologically? And that's the issue that I want to look at. And as I said, my perspective on this has changed. If you'd taken this course from me 20 years ago, probably about 22 years ago, you would have heard me arguing that Constantine was an astute politician who used Christianity to unify the empire and secure his own grab of power. I don't believe that at all now. And what is critical in doing history is not simply looking at the effects of historical decisions. And it's very easy, and evangelical and sometimes reformed historians have looked back at the impact of Constantine and seen it as a weakening of the church. They saw a man who basically accomplishes or begins the cementing together of church and state. And there are some negative things that happen with that. And Basil of Caesarea, for instance, only 50 years later, can say when the devil realized that by attacking the church openly through persecution, he was only making the church grow, what did he do? Well, he changed his strategy. So now he persecutes us through the name of Christian. And so you have a growth of nominalism in this period. And significant numbers will join the church simply because that's the only way they can get ahead in society. But all of that is that's one issue that cannot be ignored. It certainly is important in light of the history of the church. But that doesn't tell me anything about Constantine. That just tells me these are effects of his embrace of Christianity, outwardly. But what did he really believe? What did he think he was doing? Constantine was astute enough politically that when he was declared successor to his father, namely Augustus, he realized he had to contend with the other man who was the Caesar in the West. He wasn't prepared for that, and he was quite prepared then to accept the appointment of Caesar. Politically, he will seek over the next 6 years to advance himself to become the Augustus of the West, which he will succeed to doing in 312 when he defeats at a place called the Milvian Bridge outside of Rome in the year 312 a man named Maxentius. We'll talk about that. Looking then at, though, his commitments, both in terms of politically and also religiously. First of all, politically, Timothy Barnes describes him as implacably ambitious. And he was determined from the beginning of his reign to become the sole ruler of a unified Roman Empire. He did not believe in the arrangement that Diocletian made. And 306 begins a march towards that. 312 is probably the key, one of the key moments at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. This is one of the turning points of Western history. Many years later, in 335, he will tell Eusebius that before the battle, he actually saw in the heavens a Chi Rho symbol. The first two letters of the name of the Lord Jesus Christ in Greek, Christos, the Chi, looks like the X, and the Rho, very familiar symbol, was a very familiar symbol in the ancient church in identifying a household as Christian. You would often find this sometimes on silverware, on the handle of silverware, or you'd find it in a mosaic in the floor, or in various other parts of a house that was trying to identify itself as Christian. He will hear a voice, he said, by this sign, conquer. And he will actually put the Chi Rho symbol on the standards of his legions as they went into battle that day. And he would identify himself publicly as under the banner of Christ and wage war. That's another issue as well, which goes right against the early church's experience, the early church being largely pacifist. And then from 312, he wins that battle. Finally, he unifies the empire completely against the wishes of Diocletian, who's dead by this time, obviously. And he does that in the year 325. Now, that's politically. Looking at the whole area religiously, first of all, what kind of events, what kind of things are there that convinced Timothy Barnes, when he wrote this book, that although we have a man here who is implacably ambitious for power, knows the realities of power, nonetheless, all of the documentary evidence and legal evidence points to the fact that this man believed that he was a Christian. Now, it's sometimes difficult enough to know in the life of the contemporary church what people profess, whether or not. So there's no way, there's absolutely no way, we're going to be able to read the mind of some man 1,600 years ago or 1,700 years ago. Now, this is one of the major reasons why I've got very little time for psychoanalytic perspectives on historical figures, like that ridiculous book by Erik Erikson called Young Man Luther, in which basically he tries to import Freudian categories into Luther's life. Well, it's just ridiculous. I mean, first of all, there's problems of Freudianism. That's one issue. Then secondly, we've got enough, as I said, enough problems trying to figure out each other when we've got each other in front of us without trying to figure out Luther as being in glory now for 500 years or whatever. And likewise with this, it may well be that when we reach the kingdom of heaven, Constantine won't be there, and you'll say, well, Michael, you were dead wrong on this one. Obviously, I won't have any problems with that. That may well be the case, but what we have to work with is the documentary evidence. And what I'm doing with Constantine is a critical process of how you do historical work. You look at the primary sources. And for far too long, historians have looked at, well, this guy really produced a lot of problems in the church in terms of the long-term impact of the unification of church and state. That's true, but that's not the issue at hand. The issue at hand is, what did this man think he was? What did he believe he was? How are we going to decide that? You look at the sources that were left and the actions he did. His actions are not all above bar. Some of them are confusing. But the bulk of the evidence, as I went through this book, I couldn't believe it. I thought, how did I ever buy into the idea that Constantine was a hypocrite who skillfully manipulated the church for his own political ends? All the evidence points the other way, which I'm now going to present. I can't present it, obviously, in the depth that he does because you get a 400-page book, but I'll give you some of it. First of all, you've got the issue of the Cairo on the standards of his troops. Well, you might think, well, that's no big deal. Well, it is a big deal, because the men who commanded those legions, generals, the army generals, were by and large pagans. This, by the way, presents an anomaly, and I don't deny that. But if you remember back a while ago, right at the beginning of the course, one of the things I emphasized was that Rome's a military dictatorship. You need the military on your side to retain control. Now, anybody who knows power in the Roman world knows that. Constantine was raised in the halls of power. He knows that. He knows that most of his generals are implacable pagans, and that if he comes out confessedly as a Christian, he's likely to get himself assassinated. But he does it anyway. In other words, it is not a smart political move. Okay? The scholars who argue that, you know, this is all, you look at Constantine's career, it all fits the texture of a political opportunist. Well, actually, I think right from the get-go, it doesn't fit that model. Christianity comprised at most 10%, maybe 12% of the empire, at most. 6 to 7 million out of 70 million. And most of those individuals were not influential. The church wasn't filled with Cyprians. It's not like, for instance, in the Reformation in France in between 1520 and 1564, the year of Calvin's death, when 2 million had been converted, of whom 50% of the aristocracy and the middle class had embraced the Reformed faith. Like in that scenario, it makes some sense politically for the king to think, oh, okay, if I'm going to retain control of this kingdom, I need to maybe buy into the Reformed faith. And that you can see that being a smart political move to some degree. In fact, one king did, Henri de Navarre, who became Henri IV or Henri IV. But that's not what's going on here. You've got 10%, a minority, most of whom are poor, lower class, not influential. No political sense for that move. And then, secondly, you have the Edict of Milan in 313. This is one of the things I have not normally given in a course, you obviously see it in this course, I normally don't give, the only courses I ever give exams in are the language course. I teach Latin and doing first year Greek this year. I actually wrestle with exams sometimes, and maybe sometimes it'd be good to have exams. You don't have an exam. But one of the good things about exams, there are dates you should know. And 313, 312, Battle of Milvian Bridge, 313, Edict of Milan, you need to know that date. And by the Edict of Milan, he made Christianity a tolerated religion. And so he gave Christianity legal toleration. Again, as I said, this flies in the face of the majority of the society. 90% of the society do not agree with Christianity. Let's say that maybe there are significant numbers that even have a warm opinion of Christianity, though they're not committed. Even then, you're looking at 80% of the society would be against this edict. Now, it's a dictatorship. You don't have a choice. Did you have a question?
Yeah, I took Roman history in university. They're strong in teaching that at this point in time, the upper class is so infiltrated with Christianity that they, that Constantine did it.
The fourth century is the century in which the upper class does turn to Christianity, but not at the time of Constantine. You have to go 40, 50 years on, in other words, at least a couple of generations, before there is significant turning of Roman aristocracy to Christianity. And that does happen. I mean, that's undeniable. Ambrose represents that sort of turning. Basil of Caesarea comes from an aristocratic background. A number of the bishops who are significant figures in the late 4th, early 5th century are upper class, but not around the year 310, 312. I mean, there are some. You've got a Cyprian. But Christianity has not penetrated in depth the upper classes. That does not happen until the mid to late 4th century. So I would disagree with that reading.
We learned a lot.
I mean, some of these figures have Christians in their households. Philip the Arab did. I've never heard anything about Diocletian. And that might betray some of an element of knowledge that I don't have. I mean, there had been elements of, like, all the way back to Domitian in the 90s, he executes one of his relatives. And there is some evidence that the relative was a Christian. But a lot of some of the argumentation is circumstantial. I do not believe that Christianity did not have adherents from the upper classes. I think, for instance, when Ignatius of Antioch is being taken to Rome in 107 to be executed, he actually tells the Roman Church, please do not try to get me off. And the only way he could say that is he must have realized that some of these people in the Roman Church had some sort of political pull that they could get him off. In other words, could get him freed. So I do not want to in any way, shape, or form deny that Christianity had attracted certain figures in the upper class. But it is not anywhere near tipping the scales, let alone a majority. And this is not a politically wise move, in my opinion, for Constantine to make. I mean, those things are very difficult. I mean, Rodney Stark, in a book that he wrote on the rise of Christianity, he actually has percentages of how many Christians there were. He actually has it down to, like, there were 6,300,561. There's no way. I mean, we just don't have those. I mean, we have problems enough trying to figure out numbers of dissenters who went out from the Church of England in the Great Ejection in 1662. That's only 400 years ago, let alone trying to figure out, you know, how many Christians were. But all of the evidence that I've looked at, and you can look at the book by Barnes, does not indicate that there was a significant, and Barnes is primarily let me back up a little. All the evidence I've looked at does not indicate that a sizable majority of the upper class were favorable or leaning towards Christianity. What is, to me, very significant about Barnes is he's an atheist. And I remember hearing him lecture. I've heard him lecture once. And if you'd missed his opening spiel of about 5 minutes, and you'd come into the lecture, he was lecturing on the reliability of Eusebius as a historian. And if you'd come in, you'd have thought the man was a Christian. At least I would have. He's quite a remarkable individual who it's very rare for a historian to be that objective that they do not allow their presuppositions to shape their reading of a text. But at the beginning of the lecture, Barnes said very clearly, look, the truth of the matter is I don't believe any of this. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in Christianity. But none of that's got anything to do with what I'm about to talk about. So let's get on with the lecture. And so he's not coming from he doesn't have an axe to grind in this. And his specialty, he's a Roman historian. And his specialty is Roman history. And he was a professor in the classics department at U of T. So I'm at the University of Toronto. I'm not sure if he's still there. He may well have retired. But, I mean, he wrote a major book on Tertullian, which is also quite tremendous in many respects. So, I would disagree with that reading. The 4th century is the turning point for the upper class, but it's after Constantine. Thirdly, he gave funds to churches for buildings. And the classical example here is what becomes the Vatican. The foundations of the Vatican are basically the basilica that Constantine's money funded. And Constantine's Constantine's Basilica, could hold up to 4,000 worshipers. That alone is an extraordinary turn of events, because up until the early 4th century, worship was primarily house church worship. There is some indication at the end of the 3rd century that the churches were owning their own buildings. But by and large, it's house church worship. Maximum number in a house church, 80. 60 to 80. And you go from that scenario suddenly to what we would describe today. I describe 4,000 as a mega church. Maybe it's not a mega church. That's a big church, in my opinion. And there is a shift. I'm not going to look at this, but there's a whole shift in worship that takes place. Not for the best, necessarily, but a whole shift that takes place in worship. And then he gave monetary aid to widows and orphans. No Roman emperor ever did this. Why would he do that? Fifth, tax exemption to bishops and pastors. The only people who had ever been exempt from taxation in the Roman Empire were the imperial household. Not even generals were exempt. Why would he do that? The Western pattern of those in ministry being exempt from taxation goes back to Constantine. That's an absolutely remarkable innovation. Even if some of these things, let's say some of these things can be explained as a political opportunist. This makes no sense. There is no tradition for him to follow this. There's everything for him not to follow this. He doesn't even have to raise it. Number six, he established, this is a very significant one, he established episcopal courts. Let's say you were a Christian and you had a case of litigation or some sort of lawsuit against a fellow Christian. and you didn't want to go in front of a pagan judge, you want to go in front of a Christian judge. Well, what you could do is simply contact your local bishop and have your case tried by him. This does two things. One is it chews up bishops' time with legal cases. Augustine will complain mightily about how much time he spent trying to resolve legal disputes between people. Secondly, what it does, it provides, when the empire in the West will fall, the infrastructure will fall, it provides a judicial framework that continues, which in one sense is good. There's a level of stability and order in the chaos of the barbarian invasions. At another level, though, it puts power, even to the point of capital power, power of capital punishment, in the hands of bishops. And not surprisingly then, in the Middle Ages, normally when a heretic, quote-unquote, was burned, the bishops played a critical, central role in the burning of heretics, like at the trial of Jan Hus, when he is condemned by a number of bishops. They condemn him to death, hand him over to the Swiss authorities to burn, and you have the horrifying spectacle of Christian, so-called Christian bishops burning a man of God. So establishment then of episcopal courts. I mean, obviously, from Constantine's point of view, he thinks he's doing people a favor, helping them secure justice from a fellow Christian. Crucifixion is abolished. Only that one. Not any other type of punishment. But why would he abolish just that one? Well, it's, again, if you're coming at it where Barnes is coming at it from, which I think is the right perspective, which is he's seeing Constantine thinking through the implications of Christianity and the horror hitting him that we still crucify people and our Lord was crucified, we shouldn't be doing this. There should be other ways of punishing executing capital punishment. And then, number eight, this is a major mistake in the Roman Empire, unless there are convictions behind it. The gladiatorial games were banned in 325. Now, certain scholars say, well, look, it took him 13 years to get around to this one. Why didn't he do it earlier? Probably two or three reasons. Number one is he was thinking through the implications of his embrace of Christianity. Initially, he would send condemned criminals only to the gladiatorial camps. And then finally, by 325, he realizes that the whole thing has to stop. By 325, he has a unified empire under his control. And there is nobody who can stand against him. And so he has the power enough to move in this direction. This is a major... The gladiatorial games had been a staple of Roman life for nearly 500 years. And the Roman world, in many ways, the gladiatorial games epitomized the empire, because the founders, the architects of the Roman Empire, in the 2 centuries B.C., one of the things that they came to realize was that many of the young Roman men who were not living near the frontiers would never actually see bloodshed. But to steal them, S-T-E-S-T-E-E-L, to the site of bloodshed, the games were a vital part of that. The games were not just a means of entertainment, but they were also a means of a way of producing a certain type of Roman character. The same sort of character, for instance, that when a Roman century, 100 men, failed to achieve its objective in a battle, what the commanders would do after the battle, they'd line up the 100 men, or those who were left. Every 10th man would be brought out of the line, and he would then be clubbed to death by his fellows. And a Roman process known as decimation, from the word every, from 10. And Roman life, there's a violence built into the Roman Empire, and the gladiatorial games are part of that. And by the time you get to this period, I don't follow hockey, so you'll forgive the hockey illusion. But no, it's baseball. It was baseball, right, that had the strike. Or was it hockey? Both of them, okay. I mean, if I'd been the head of the NHL, I think I would have fired them all and started over again. I mean, anyway. But, I mean, there was significant unrest. Well, you can imagine if our governments basically said, that's it, you know, hockey's gone, baseball's gone, pro football's gone, it's just gone, you know, because of the violence. Basketball's gone, too. I'm a Canadian, basketball's not big in Canada. I mean, there'd be significant unrest. I mean, if you did that in parts of Europe today with soccer, I mean, there'd be major riots. I mean, they have riots when they have the games. So the gladiatorial games were just a part of fabric of Roman life. This guy comes along, says, that's it, they're off. Now, he does replace them with something, and chariot racing. But if you're a sadist, it's not as much fun. People did get killed now and then. Chariot racing could be fairly bloody because sometimes the fans would riot. And they actually had four teams in Constantinople, the Reds, the Blues, the Greens, and the Whites. And there would be riots after the chariot racings against those who hadn't won or who did win or whatever. But anyway. I'm not sure I want to make that connect all the way back. Soccer, actually, the mob violence you see, at least in England, that mob violence goes very far back. There is, despite our view of the British, you know, there is a significant vein of violence that kind of is there in British society in the lower levels. And then in 321, Sunday is made a required holiday. The only people exempt from this, nobody can work on that day. The only people exempt from this are farmers during harvest time. Again, you have to ask the question, why? I mean, why would he do this? What does he stand to gain politically from this? Divorce and remarriage are made far more difficult. In Roman culture, very different from Greek and Jewish culture, both men and women could initiate divorce proceedings. It was fairly easy for a man to divorce his wife. I'm not sure where Constantine got the following from, but he didn't get it necessarily from Scripture, but the only reason why a woman could divorce her wife, now from this point on, was if he were a murderer, a poisoner, or a tomb violator. That is a guy who regularly broke into tombs to get wealth. A man could divorce his spouse if she were guilty of adultery, which would be biblical, poisoning, or running a brothel. So I'm not sure how he came up with the different perspectives. But what he did do was against the grain of Roman custom, because he made divorce and remarriage much more difficult. And then he removed legal disabilities against the unmarried. Removed legal disabilities against the unmarried. Now this is overturning a law that goes all the way back to Augustus Caesar. Augustus Caesar had passed a law such that if you were a woman over the age of 16, you were taxed every year if you weren't married. If you were a woman over the age of 16 and married without children, you were taxed. If you were a male over the age of 18 without marriage, you were taxed. And if you were a male over the age of 18 without children, you were taxed. Married and without children, you'd be taxed. And obviously a higher rate of taxation if you are unmarried rather than if you're married without children. And the whole goal is typical of a state that needs men. You know, you're encouraging marriage because the goal of marriage is children. We need young men for the state, for the army. And basically, Constantine kicks all of it out. And again, behind that would be the fact that some would choose celibacy for the sake of the kingdom. Now, alongside all of that, I'm going to look at, after the break, at some documentary evidence. Alongside all of that, though, or rather over against all of that, a number of scholars say, well, look, the evidence is not conclusive because there is the evidence of coinage. A number of his coins reveal the use of a pagan symbol, the Sol Invictus, which is the invincible sun, which appears to indicate that what you've got there is some sort of syncretism going on. My argument in response to that would be what you've got there is a man who is politically adept and realizes that while he can make certain political moves that are demonstrated in this legislation, he cannot completely dismantle paganism overnight. And he still has to keep happy of significant sectors of society. He does make certain moves against paganism. For instance, in Roman pagan religion was the use of what is known as a haruspex. A haruspex was really, for lack of a better term, a witch doctor. Let's say you had an important decision to make in your life, a change of jobs, change of locale, or whatever. You'd have a haruspex come in, you'd sacrifice an animal, he would take the intestines, after suitable ritual prayer, read the intestines for the answer from the gods. And Constantine passed a law that if you were discovered with a haruspex in your home, the haruspex would be executed, and you would suffer the loss of all your property and be internally exiled.